You feeling good? You ready to go?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm as good as I'm going to get.
That's.
It was just an unusual day.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you're topping it off with this podcast.
Oh, yeah. That's... Well, I think I'm kind of fired up. Like, all my synapses are like, bing, bing, bing.
So many damn books.
Hello and welcome to So Many Damn Books, a blessing, a curse, a podcast. My name is Christopher, and I'm joined actually in the damn library by Idra Novi. Idra, I'm so excited to have you here. It's been too long since I've actually had a live guest. I've been Zooming with my guests for so long. So I'm glad you're actually here sitting in front of me drinking a drink that I made for you. Idra Novi is the award-winning author of the novels Ways to Disappear and Those Who Knew. Her work has been translated into a dozen languages, and she has written for The Atlantic, The New York Times, and The Los Angeles Times. She teaches fiction at Princeton University and in the MFA program at New York University. And you knew all of those things, but maybe the people at home didn't.
Yes, I do those things. I'm thrilled to be here in person.
I'm so glad that you could be here, and I can't wait to talk about your new novel, Take What You Need. Your novel's out today. People should be listening to this on the way to the bookstore to pick this up because it's out. People can go get this wonderful book, and I am excited to talk to you about it. But before we get to that fun stuff, I want to talk to you about the drink that I made for you. The character in your book is a artist. She's a sculptor, and she makes these things called manglements that she calls manglements. And I was just thinking about how when I am wandering the Chelsea galleries, it's so nice to have something to be holding in your hand, to be looking at the art, and to have something to also be experiencing with a flavor. And so I was thinking, like, what sort of drink would I pair? And so I was looking in my freezer, I found strawberries, and strawberries have this sort of folkloric meaning of dedication because of all of the seeds that they can send out, the dedication to the craft, maybe. And then chamomile, is used in spells and in folklore magic to attract love. And I just think that art is so much about dedication and, attracting love. And then for just making a good drink, it needed lemon. So strawberry, chamomile, lemon. I'm calling this drink Accompanying Manglements.
Amazing. And I think libidinal forces are a big factor in this book. So the fact that you put in some chamomile as an aphrodisiac feels spot on.
It's really delicious. And it's the type of mocktail that I feel like is popping up on menus now, that I feel like I would just order, not because, like, I love a fun drink. I just want a fun drink at all times. So the fact that we are now moving past, like, only the fun drinks have alcohol in them, and now they're just making fun drinks that don't have alcohol in them, I like to join that world. I'm part of that troop too, wanting to make those. And so this is something that anybody can enjoy. Making strawberry syrup is really fun and really easy. And so this would be a fun one to try making at home.
It's
all those
delicious
people out there. Oh, I'm so glad. I'm so glad to hear it. And I think it kind of matches the sort of sunset.
I know. It's sort of color. It's like in the same chromatic area as the book.
Yeah. You can go to somanydamnbooks.com to look at all the drinks that I've ever made on this podcast, on the damn bar. And check out everything, including this one. Or you can look at the Instagram for a picture of this drink if you want to do that. But what I want to do now is do the next section of this show. I'm very good at segues. This is called What Did You Buy? Idra, have you bought anything, book or otherwise, interesting recently?
I received a fantastic galley today of Gina Apostol's new novel, La Tercera. And what I did buy were slippers. Somebody says, what are you going to do to celebrate your new novel? And I was thinking what I really needed, and my dog had eaten my slippers.
Oh.
And so I decided, Because I'm a really wild person who drinks mocktails and buys slippers to celebrate. And wreaths, that's what I would get.
Oh, that's so great. Tell me about the Apostol book. What's going on with that? What's that about?
Well, I just got it today.
Okay.
I know it's set in the Philippines.
Okay.
And I've been a big fan of Gina's earlier books. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking forward to reading this one. It looks like it's about several generations of families. I think it's coming out in May.
Nice. And then the slippers.
Yeah.
Those special in some way as well? Are those like a brand that you always go to?
Well, nobody's eaten them yet.
That does make them pretty special. I like that. I picked up a couple really exciting things. I got Ruby Tandow's. She was the people who are fans of the Great British Baking Show might recognize her name. She was a finalist in 2013, and she's since been sort of a vocal, like, that wasn't a super fun experience for me. But she has, like many of the contestants, have come out with various cookbooks and baking books. And this one, Cook As You Are, Recipes for Real Life Hungry Cooks and Messy Kitchens. It just seemed completely up my alley just because it's got a lot of variations on the recipes in there. And something that I thought was interesting was she was like, all the photos that accompany these books are not just photos of food. They're also class markers and lifestyle markers and markers of the background. So she wanted to take that all out. And so it's just illustrated. She did get her illustrator to illustrate techniques and everything. So they're still in there. But it's not so, you know, it has to look this way or you're messing up that, or you have to use this perfect tool or you're messing up. It's much more catch as catch can. And if you don't have this, you can substitute this in instead. Very fun approach to making a cookbook. And then I also got from the good people at Tin House, Katie Holton's book, The Language of Trees. And so this is a rewilding of literature and landscape. And Katie Holton created a alphabet out of trees and then gathered up these great collections of writing about the natural world. And some of it she translates into her tree alphabet. But it includes writing from folks like Ursula K. Le Guin and Robin Wall Kimmerer, as well as Plato, just all sorts of different people writing on nature and its power. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful object. It's got that cool sort of three-quarter dust jacket with a neat, like, printed cloth-bound cover.
It's a beautiful book. And I also love this question from William Corman. Why are there no trees in Paleolithic cave drawings? I mean, that hasn't occurred to me, but it's a good question.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's what I got. Now, without further ado, your novel, Take What You Need. I would love to hear from you how you describe this book to people. How do you tell someone who hasn't read it yet what it's about?
I think my description of this book changes according to the time of day, maybe because it's the colors of the cover. Mm-hmm. But I would say that this is a novel about polarization and about disconnects between people over political and cultural divides and the question of whether art is a way to reconnect.
Yeah, that's high level.
It's about welding. It's about torching shit. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this central relationship is between Leah and Jean. And Jean is an artist and was her stepmother.
Yes.
And Leah was her stepdaughter, but Leah's dad divorced or left Jean while she was very young. And I've never seen this type of relationship depicted before, this stepdaughter, but they've left before, you know, like, I feel like I've had some version of that, but never quite where the stepmother is not part of the daughter's life anymore. How did this come about? How did you start with this relationship?
Well, it's a great question. I have a stepmother. We're very close. In fact, she was at my house today. But I've talked with her, I think, as I've gotten older, about sort of the precarious place of being a stepmother. Because, you know, if, you know, she sort of was all in as a parent to me and to my sister. And I think that Jean in the novel was just all in as a mother to Leah. And very different from my life. I mean, my mom's alive and she was one of several figures, but a very loving, devoted parent, and still is. And so I think I was just thinking about, you know, certain conversations I've had with her and just what it means to be a stepmother. And then I was just thinking about the positions of, you know, women in art who are sort of seen as sort of suspect and precarious. And, you know, even sort of like the role certainly of rural artists in our national imagination. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of ways that those sort of, you know, that sort of precarious status as of a parent, like they're not really, step parents aren't really seen as full parents the way they are, you know, if you are a full on parent. And also, you know, when a marriage dissolves, and I've seen this happen with a number of friends where they're very, very close to kids and then they don't want to leave the marriage because they don't want to lose the relationship to kids becomes a reason to stay, which is what it is for Jean until it becomes intolerable. So when she does leave Leah's father, she, you know, doesn't expect that she will also lose her connection. But he's retaliatory and vengeful, and that's sort of what happens, which sadly I think often happens, that children become, you know, these sort of ways of sort of enacting, you know, unresolved emotions between parents.
It's so powerful the way that that is depicted. My first read through of this book, I just was so connected to that connection and how heartbreaking it must be to have this connection that you feel is so important for both of them, because they both have this instant rapport and understanding of one another that's then ripped from them. But then this book is not about, like, it's not just like a, I guess it's just not linear, you know, it's completely, these timelines are completely divorced from one another. Leah's timeline and her perspective and Jean's timeline and her perspective are completely separate. And that seems to me like another piece of the puzzle here that is just yours. What, can you talk about this construction?
Yes, it's funny. I think that just intuitively felt right for the book. All of my books have had multiple points of view, and I think I'm just very interested in blind spots. And I also think that there's a way to create momentum in a book by switching narrators and creating tension through sort of the misperceptions or the ways that they mishear each other. So I think that why I like doing multiple points of view, one, I think it's inherently democratic, because whenever you have multiple perspectives, you immediately see that every perspective has its limits, as we all have limits, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that seems to me to sort of have an emotional truth to it that you sort of allows. And of course, there's other ways to do that with one narrator, through dialogue, through these other things. I'm not saying it's the only way to do it, but I think it just feels dynamic to me, mm-hmm, to be able to do this, sort of bring in these different voices that sort of, you know, shine a light on the limitations between them and these blind spots and the ways that they sort of are limited and how they can see their own mistakes and other people's mistakes and other people's lived realities. And so that is a way to, I think, create tension where you sort of move from one narrator to the other. And so, yes, they do jump in time, but I think in my mind, I saw them as building piece by piece on the story of who they have become because of each other.
Mm. And just from a pure craft or getting down to the page perspective, were you going from in between their perspectives in your writing days as well? Or were you writing as far as you could with one? Or did you write the whole side of Jean and then the whole side of, how did you actually...
It's a great question. With Ways to Disappear, when I wrote Ways to Disappear, I had just finished translating Clarice Lispector's The Passion According to G.H., where the last line of a chapter becomes the first line, Clarice Lispector's last line of one chapter becomes the first line of the next one. And I played with that because I had just translated it and I was like still processing all of that, where that happens in Ways to Disappear. But it wasn't a total line. Like one chapter would end with beans and then the next chapter would start with beans. Also, I love beans. And then when I was doing those Who Knew, which had more narrators, I was also sort of thinking about how some image or something that was sort of pending would then sort of continue in some sort of way with the next. I often broke scenes in the middle by switching narrators. I think it sort of has like a propulsive power. And so I think that's just become how I write novels, because I think I come from poetry. So I'm sort of thinking in discrete sections. So I wrote everything in the order it is, building on the ways that they sort of add to each other, you know, sort of a sense of accumulative power.
I love this, what you were talking about with blind spots and this sort of cumulative power thing, because I think Ways to Disappear, there's just little blind spots that don't quite have the bearing that this one huge blind spot, because this novel is sort of like all around sort of this black hole of one thing that is coloring everything around it.
Yes.
But Ways to Disappear were little, I mean, it was this comic moment actually that I absolutely loved from that, from Ways to Disappear, where your character has bought a very floppy hat to keep the sun out of her eyes, because she is usually wearing
in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
And Brazil sunlight is not like Pittsburgh sunlight.
And then everybody else who sees her in that hat is like, you look so stupid in that hat. Why on earth would you have bought that? And this is not played for any sort of laughs. This is always like, I felt the heartbreak rise in me for every successive chapter of this book, because I so wanted these characters to meet and have their catharsis.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, maybe because one gets older and writes more books, that the catharsis, when it happens, is often not as you would imagine it. And it may not be with the actual person. It may be with the art they left behind. It may be with something else that isn't exactly as you imagined that moment of you know, reconciliation. I think, you know, it's hard to set it up in a way that is going to satisfy the way you expect. And so I think I didn't know how that was going to play out in the book when I was writing it. You know, I didn't know what, there were certain things that I think I was like, they were a surprise for me. And I kind of just trusted that, because then I hope they would be a surprise for the reader. So, if you know too much, then you sort of lose a little wildness.
Yeah. The wildness of this book is partially just from the art that's being created, that Jean is making. And I felt like I could see it very, very clearly. But I've been fascinated by the idea of art that's a reference to real art that you can just pull up versus art that the author made up. And I was just wondering how you feel about when you're seeing art described and it exists, do you want to go and like pull it up and see that piece? Or are you happy with the artist's construction? I mean, the writer's construction of the art for yourself?
That's a fascinating question. And so when you said it, I was like, oh, I think I like things that are ineffable and the sort of challenge. I mean, I think translation, there's something that you have to imagine that is impossible to recreate, you know, so that if you're moving something from one language to another, there's something ineffable that you can't entirely recreate. You have to make something new in your own mind. And so I think in Ways to Disappear, because I was already thinking about translation, I ended up writing about this writer, Beatriz Yagoda, who's invented, her books don't exist. And I had the fun of making up scenes, you know, about all these sons named Bruno. I mean, I loved writing those parts of her work. And then with Those Who Knew, I invented a whole country. You know, I invented this island and this nation and its history, which of course you can't go and visit and you can't look up the country because it doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And so now I made up a body of work. So in a way, I think that there's something about coming up with some ineffable world, whether it's the world of Jean's towers that she makes in this book, or Beatriz Yagoda's works, which don't exist, or the island nation where all those characters live, which doesn't exist anywhere. I think there's something about that that has become sort of part of what I think about when I'm making a work of fiction, that it has some sort of metafictional aspect to it, of like a world within a world that I can kind of play with. I think it keeps it, it gives you, so it's not just about characters, because I think that just like straight realism doesn't compel me the way it is when I get to do something metafictional. I think that it adds this other layer of ways to pursue the themes of the book when you add a metafictional layer.
I had just finished reading this book, and I was in Philadelphia, and I was wondering, the artist Isaiah Zagar, who made this incredible installation called The Magic Gardens of Philadelphia, which is just this incredible mixed media. There's these tunnels and these bridges, and it's all inlaid with broken ceramics, and sometimes there's phrases and things. And I thought it was so strange that I felt like this is so close to being what was depicted in your book, but and you haven't been.
I can't wait to, you know, I didn't set up a Philadelphia reading, and I was like, well, I think I will have to go read in Philadelphia because I need to get to the Magic Gardens.
Yeah, you absolutely need to.
I have been a number of times to the American Visionary Art Museum.
Okay.
Which, as the sort of works you were describing, are, you know, I love that it's called the American Visionary Art Museum, because the idea is that they're not trying to create sort of a category for who gets to be in that museum and who is elsewhere. It's really about the quality of the work and the pursuit of a vision in the work, as opposed to within a school or in conversation with anyone else. Like, I think the whole idea of visionary art is that it isn't necessarily, you know, can be compared to things that are happening with contemporaries. It's really a vision of its own, apart. And that's what makes for visionary art. And so what you're saying about the Magic Gardens, what I think about with Jean's Vanglements, is that they don't fit easily into any other sort of movement happening now.
And of course, what a mind to be walking around in and being a part of. Can you talk about creating Jean and making her character into a living, breathing sort of person?
Well, she's an amalgam of various actual living, breathing people and invention. And I came to really crave her company, especially during the pandemic, because this isn't a pandemic novel, but it is about isolation. And I think it's about the kind of risks you might take with art or what you might say when you're not thinking about the approval of other people. You know, and we're in this era of always watching and judging each other and editorializing on things. And I think part of me was sort of craving what it would be like. What art would I be making? What would I be writing if I wasn't anticipating an audience at any point? Like, how does that shift the art that we make? And I was thinking about, you know, when I wrote a play when I was in high school, and the only people who came to see it, because I think nobody paid attention to it. Like, I went to a rural public high school. So, there was a lot of talk about football games, but nobody knew what the theater club was doing. And so the only people who came to the play that I wrote, was like the only student-written play I think ever performed at the school, were the parents of the people in the play. And it didn't matter. You know, it was like the whole auditorium was empty. And I think in my mind, I'm like, that's what I'm writing for. I'm writing for like the 10 people who show up in Johnstown, Pennsylvania to see a play. And it has to sort of be about that and not about sort of, you know, approval seeking or trying to sort of anticipate how other people are going to react. And so I wanted that spirit to be part of Jean's art, to be part of the way she makes art, because she's, you know, in rural, you know, Allegheny Highlands, where she doesn't anticipate an audience. And so that frees her to sort of make art in this more instinctive way.
As you're working on a new book, how much is the new book an answer to the last book that you wrote, or your body of work so far? Do you think of your past books when you're working on a new one and things you want to be, make sure you don't do or something? Or are you fully present?
It's a great question. I mean, I don't want to be derivative. I don't want to become a caricature of myself where you're sort of trying to play off of things that you did well or that you felt confident about having written in a previous book. I think I want to be more contrarian and sort of always depart from the previous books in some way. You know, I think I've already run through 3 genres at this point. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm already not, you know, I always am trying to be like, well, what can I come up with that would just take everybody and myself by surprise? Because I think I kind of like coming from like a beginner's mindset, or like, you know, like the sort of like novice mindset, where you just feel a little trepidatious and I think a little humbled, because there's something you're trying to do that you're not good at yet.
Right.
I really like that. Mm-hmm. I think there's something that feels risky about that and exciting. So I think in every book I've tried to do something that I haven't done before and that there's a very high chance I can't do. And I have started books I haven't finished. Mm-hmm. But I think when there is a risk of failure, of trying something that you haven't done before, that that you feel a little wobbly and then you take more risks because it doesn't feel too familiar.
Right. And yet you come back, I think, to this space of the sort of gulf between intention and perception.
Right.
I feel like that is the place that you're where I've noticed that your characters are often going. And I wondered if that is something that then bleeds over into your life too, of trying to see other people's perspectives on you, or feeling like I don't understand that person's story, or just making up stories for people as you're walking around.
Well, this was the only book where I interviewed a lot of people, and it was set in, you know, it's set in this invented fictional town in the Allegheny Highlands, but it's very similar to the town where my grandmother grew up, where my mother grew up. We all grew up in different towns, but all within short distance from each other. So same area. And, but I haven't lived there in a long time. My brother lives there. My parents are there. I was like a lived place. I have friends who stayed there. I go back a lot. But I, especially because I was writing this like sort of 2016 on, you know, I started this novel before those who knew. So I've been at it a while. And then I had to come back to it. I was interviewing a lot of people and actually thought I was going to do like an oral history, sort of like Voices of Chernobyl, you know, mm-hmm. but about like a politically divided town. That was the idea. And then I was like, interviewed this one woman who I met in her husband's barbershop, and she made these amazing collages on cigar boxes, and she went to flea markets at 4:30 in the morning and collected these things and made art and just was so drawn to art and would drive all over and just find beautiful things that just struck her. And I just, her spirit and her voice became part of the book, and she's become a really good friend. Her name is Helen Golubich, and so her voice became something that I would play. Mm-hmm. Before I wrote, and I would hear her voice. It's not her. This character is not her. But there was something about her vitality and her sort of irascible personality and her passion for art that wasn't fueled by anything else around her. She just had it in her. And it's interesting. I mean, I don't have any other artists in my family. You know, mm-hmm. Nobody. I don't know why I have this need to wake up every morning and write things. But I mean, I wake up and I that's the only thing I want to do. It's like part of my neuroprocessing. And it has always been. You know, I was always writing plays for kids in the neighborhood. I don't know why. Like, why did that happen? Why am I so drawn to write things? I mean, there's no explanation from the people in my family before me or even after me. I'm just sort of an Emily in that way. And so I was interested in Jean that way too. The same thing with this woman, Helen. Like, why are certain people like just have this compulsion to make art, and it can't really be explained by context? I think there's something mysterious there that is just sort of their particles came together and it just becomes part of their being. And, you know, as much as we want to talk about sort of people and, you know, who they are and where they are, there's something more that you can't, that's a little more inexorable.
Sorry, I'm just thinking about that, for letting that sit for a second. You do thank a metal shop.
I do.
Yeah. It made me wonder if you set out to try to make some art, and just so you knew how it felt, and how did that all go?
Well, I learned to weld because I wanted to learn how to weld. And my family has a scrapyard in Western Pennsylvania, which is sort of the idea where I got the scrapyard, where Jean gets her scrap metal is from her cousins. And so my mother's cousin runs the Novi scrapyard. We never had any material connection to it. It was patrilineal.
Okay.
So it went from my great-grandfather to his son, etc. So I descend from the women of that family. So I've never had any material collection and actually had never been there. But I wanted to go because my namesake, Ida Novi, started the scrapyard in 1906. So in some way, cool. This became an homage, I think, to Ida Novi, because I have her name except for the R, and I never met her. And so I went back and saw the scrapyard, and I just didn't feel any connection to it because maybe I'm a little scrappy, but I don't actually know that much about scrap metal. And so this became a way, welding with scrap metal, to connect to this namesake I never met. And to do something as, you know, as a writer and as an artist with scrap metal, because it wasn't my material legacy, but I can choose it as a legacy.
And so, and how was welding?
It's so fun. I highly recommend torching things.
Yeah.
Yes. You get to cover your face. You have to put this thing over because the light is so sharp, it can sort of burn your retina. So I really liked making art where you're actually sort of masked. It's kind of fun. Mm-hmm. But then you can't actually see that well unless you have a very clean. So it's hard because it's very tricky work to sort of get the weld right. And if you do it too long, you burn through the metal. But if you do it not enough, you don't melt it. So it really requires great skill and great eyesight. But I think you have this mask over. And so I had no idea the physical sort of challenges of doing it. And then they became really interesting to me. And I studied welding with 3 different people. Wow. And they all had very different ideas about how to make a box, which is interesting because it's just 6 sides.
Right.
And that was fascinating to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of, it's like that old Carl Sagan, like, how do you make a pie? Well, first you have to create the universe. Like, how do you make a box? I just feel like you could make that a real philosophical question.
It really is. It really is. Like, sometimes when you write as simple or straightforward as a pie might be or a box might be, that actually it's very revealing of somebody's sensibility. What do you do with 6 sides? Do you let some light in? Do you seal it up? What do you do with your sides, you know?
Yeah, do you leave the box open? Because otherwise it's a cube. I don't know.
I mean, I think for Jean, she's been so boxed in by her father, by her ex-husband, by the choices she's had, that for her, letting light in is the reason for the box.
Right. Your novels are all on the shorter side. And I love short novels. But these don't feel like other short novels. Like, they don't feel like they cut off at like halfway through or something. They feel complete. And like, I don't know. I just feel like they're so satisfying. And I would be curious if you have sort of a philosophy about short novels, or is this just how long your novels are?
Thank you. That's very validating to hear, because I think we do often equate length with sort of heft in terms of reader experience, but I don't really think that they are proportional. And I love short novels too, simply because I don't like extra words. I like concision. I like understatement. I like novels that move from intense sensory moments. And I think that I'm not drawn to write connective tissue. I don't need to get somebody in the door, hang up the coat, take off their shoes, put on their slippers. I'm a big fan of slippers, you know, but I don't need to see all of that. I just, you know, and I know that sometimes, you know, radical thoughts can happen when you hang up your coat, and, you know, very tense, you know, provocative moments can happen in those in-between spaces, but not to just put the connective tissue in just because you need to lead from one scene to another. Like, I just think that those kinds of conventions aren't of interest to me as a writer.
Mm. How do you feel about when a novel shows up that people are talking about and it's like 1,000 pages? Do you feel like people need to edit, or are you, or can you fall into a long novel as well?
I wish all those people good luck.
You suggested a really interesting companion piece. I mean, this is such a good book to read alongside having either before even and then reading your novel, or afterwards, On Contemporary Art by Cesar Ayra.
Ayra.
That R is hard for me. And it's got a foreword by friend of the show, Will Chancellor, and an afterword by friend of the show, Alexander Kleeman. So this was a very lovely book because I just felt like my friends were all showing me how great On Contemporary Art is. Why did you recommend this book in particular?
Well, I'm a big fan of Cesar Ayra, who, as you know, writes very short novels and has a very different process from mine in that he doesn't edit. He just sort of sees it through and then just lets it be what it is, which I can't imagine because I'm an obsessive editor of everything. And I think probably for every page that's in this novel, I probably threw away 10. Like, whoa. I probably wrote 1,000 pages.
Yeah.
You know, I have so many things that I threw away to get to these 250 pages. It's not that I don't write all those pages. I just don't keep them. whereas for Cesar Aida, he does keep the pages. And those are all the pages he has. I admire that. There's something audacious about it. And this particular, I there's a couple ideas in contemporary art in this that I that are great. And I think Will Chancellor's introduction to it is so fascinating because he talks about as a kid, Will Chancellor, if not Cesar Aida, in the intro, seeing that warning on the mirror in the car as a child, which says that things are closer than they appear, and how it troubled him that adults who would be driving and seeing that weren't able to see things as they are.
Mm-hmm.
And that in fact is something inherent to art. Is like that disjunct between things that they are and has as we perceive them. And that's something that sort of art can pursue. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was such a great introduction to this discussion of contemporary art, because Cesar Aida sort of puts forth that art presents new values. But then halfway through the essay, he was like, who needs values?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's so funny that he doesn't edit, because to me, he like... he like fought with himself and he was like, eh, I don't know, and then just like stopped.
Yeah, he sort of undermines his own argument. He comes up with this great lofty idea and then he's like, maybe that's a load of crap. I mean, it's really sort of like and I like that he sort of is, you know, open to questioning his own, you know, main argument. So there's something sort of, you know, cheeky about it in a likable way. But I think what I was thinking about, what we're thinking about Jean, was like, well, what new values is she putting forth in making art out of discards? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and is there a value in thinking about the value of art? Or is the whole point of art is that you don't have to make a case for its value?
One of my favorite things about Jean is that she keeps up obsessively with the art world. She reads her art world magazines that come to her house cover to cover, and she knows all of these and plays with the ideas and thinks about them and throws those ideas out at other people that as though they're just going to be interested in grappling with them alongside her. And that's such a lovely person to meet and know, but she is not in the right environment for all of those ideas to flourish. And when he's talking about art, he's also looking at the art magazines and looking specifically at this thing that I always think about when I'm looking at my iPhone pictures of after I went to a museum, that, well these are terrible. These aren't good pictures of art. And he was sort of looking at that mediation of why is that true and sort of taking that apart. And that was the idea that I'm still sort of pulling apart for myself. I think that this line where he's saying that a work of art has always implicitly contained its own reproduction. First of all, I really like that because it's something to sort of, it's nearly a paradox. And
there's a lot to chew on.
I like that a lot. But then he says, by being exposed to perception and memory, ghosts are inevitably released into space and time. And yes, like the ghost of that art, it's not, I mean, I remember seeing certain pieces of art that I couldn't have seen then because I look up how that piece of art moved across the country or was in some sort of tour and it couldn't have been there when I was thinking that I saw it there. So how does that happen? And those sorts of ghosts or misrememberings alongside like, what did that mean for you then? And are you the same person stepping into the river? That type of question as well. All of that is right on the surface here. And it's one of the great things about little books that are just have an idea to chew on that suddenly you feel a little bit smarter for having grappled with a larger concept. That's not just like, oh, I was trying to find something and I found it, because he doesn't find it. And neither does Will Chancellor, and neither does Alexander Kleeman at the end. No one's finding anything here. They're just thinking. And they're not saying that these are finished thoughts either.
Yes, but I think Will Chancellor points out that you know, his intro is about a mirror, and Alexander Kleeman's, you know, afterward is about a line. So it's more about the pursuit. It's the looking into the mirror, seeing what it says, seeing your own face mixed up with this puzzling line. And Alexander Kleeman's like, it's really about being in the line. It's not about where you get to. So even if, you know, you're waiting in the line and then somebody says, actually, we're closed, the experience of being in the line, although I hate lines, I would go another day, but I love the metaphor of it, is that it's like, you know, it's the pursuit of it, whether you actually get there or not. But I mean, I think that's true for Jean in this novel. You know, she's just, it's the making that she's in it for.
That Alexander Kleeman part about the line resonated very strongly with me very early in my having moved to New York. The Goldfinch, Donna Tartt's novel, came out, and you know, as a fan, I wanted to go see the piece. But it was at a tiny gallery. Everyone was there to see that one. Everyone there is also a Donna Tartt fan, holding their book that has the the art that they're gonna go see, which I loved. But I didn't get in. I didn't get in that day that they were closing the. And I went home and I told my roommate at the time, like, I didn't get in. He's like, New York is all about lines. You're gonna wait in some great lines in New York.
There you have it.
And I was just, I was revisiting that idea.
Also revisiting is Cesar Aida's notion that art has inside of it its own reproduction. There's an example, because it ended up on the book. And everyone came, sounds like, with the reproduction to see the original.
Odd, but great.
Yes, maybe.
Maybe not. Free space to continue doing. That was another quote from this, that art is this free space that is just keep making things happen.
Yeah.
That's all you need.
And actually physically making things. And I think I was drawn to that too, in part because during the pandemic, when we couldn't go wait in lines to go see exhibits, people were looking at art online. It just wasn't as satisfying. Ugh. You're not there in your body experiencing the sculpture. You can't walk around it. You can't, you know, talk about it. You can't look at it and look back. You can't just sort of be alone with it and see it, the full color and the everything about it. And so I think that was also something that I was sort of craving, was just thinking about the physical presence of a work of art and imagining the experience of both making it and seeing it. And I just missed that so much.
Mm. Yeah, I remember taking some amount of, I guess, emotional damage or something on the days that they, during the pandemic, museums would breathlessly announce that they've created a fantastic virtual tour of, and I was just thinking, no, that's not at all it. And to even pretend like that is what we all want seems like antithetical to your whole mission. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I remember thinking like, I don't even have a good enough monitor to correctly display some of these things. Like, I'm not even going to see the right color here.
No. You know, I spoke to the head of the new head, because was it Barbara Hofberger, who was the original founder of the American Visionary Art Museum. And there's a new woman who's taken over. And when I spoke with her, I was asking her, you know, there's a lot more museums that, you know, they were like, oh, are people going to come back after the pandemic? And people have absolutely come back. They love great lines and they're in them, having great experiences, can write about them as afterwards someday. And then you also have, you know, a lot more outsider artists or visionary artists who are off the grid artists who are being, you know, whose work is being shown in what is more, you know, sort of institutions that usually sort of only do artists that are sort of part of, you know, institutionalized groups.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked her about that. And I was like, well, what is the role of like at the American Visionary Art Museum or when these museums are trying to make a place for that? She's like, well, you know, I think they're trying to make it for their inclusiveness. But actually, the American Visionary Art Museum was doing it all along.
Mm.
And it was always the most diverse museum mm-hmm. in Baltimore. And always the one that had the most women. Not because anyone was counting, but simply because that was who was shut out of the institutional shows.
Right.
And those were people who were sort of shut out of experiences because they were caretakers. because they didn't have access, because they had to do other jobs. And so art happened because they were into it for the making.
Hmm. I'm so glad that whatever dire ideas people had about what people wouldn't come back to, is they've all been wrong. Everybody wanted to come back and live their lives as they used to. We didn't learn anything from the pandemic, so that's fine.
even gross gyms, people went back to gross.
I know. They did, didn't they? Well, you've written about writers, translators, artists, political activists, bookstore owners. I feel like there are a few artistic...
And playwrights.
Yes.
Freddie's a playwright. I got to pretend to be a playwright, too.
Oh, that's right. Basically, I'm asking, what sort of artistic temperament are you thinking about trying to chronicle next, if you could say?
Puppets.
Puppets. Wow. Do you want to say more there, or do you want to just let that hang in the ether by the strings that it hold it up? Okay. Well, that's great. I would be able to sit here and talk to you for ages and ages, but the next thing to happen regularly on this podcast is recommendations, and the people need to hear what you would recommend to them. What do you recommend from the world? It can be books, but maybe you have other recommendations. Could be anything.
I would recommend Nona Fernandez's new book, Voyager, coming out from Grey Wolf, I think, this week. I think she's an under-recognized, incredibly inventive Chilean writer. I would recommend Fennel, which I think people don't eat as much as they should. It's delicious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Makes a great soup. Fennel and leeks. Love it.
Yeah. It's sort of curious how little fennel we eat when it actually doesn't go bad. You can have it for a long time.
Yeah?
I think if you have a small fridge, fennel's the way to go.
Okay. I am going to recommend a song. I heard this song today. I've played it too many times over and over. It's called Who the Hell is Edgar? It's Austria's entry into the Eurovision contest this year by an artist named Teja and Selena, and one of them finds themselves possessed by the ghost of Edgar Allan Poe, and that is the basis of their song for the Eurovision Song Competition.
I'm gonna have to write that down.
It's so good and so funny.
I can't wait to hear this. I have another book recommendation to add.
Oh, good.
70 Times 7 by Alex Marr, that's coming out at the end of March. Her last book was about witches in America.
I love that book.
It's fantastic.
So good.
And this is a very different book. I think that it's a deep dive, sort of looking at the ways we think about forgiveness or our lack of forgiveness or mercy in terms of people who are convicted of homicide, and especially for youth who are convicted of homicide, and what kind of country we are when we're in the business of, you know, prosecuting children for the rest of their lives. And as sort of hard and painful, it's actually in some ways a book about what it means to be capable of mercy. It's a really moving book, so recommend it.
That's so different than Witches in America.
So different, yes.
Which I've read that book a few times. Alex Marr is great. I'm definitely going to be checking that out. And then I'm going to recommend, everybody needs to go and buy Take What You Need. It's an incredible book. It moved me so much, and I've already been rereading passages and everything. It really caught me by complete surprise. Your publicist was sort of dogged in getting me to read it, and I'm so glad she was, because I loved it. And so thank you for writing it. So everybody who is listening, that's one thing you need to do. Another thing you should do is write a review on iTunes of this show, because I need reviews of the show to keep it up in all of the algorithms and all of that. And it's also really nice when people go to patreon.com/smdb and support the show there. You get special things like special excerpts of the show that I haven't put anywhere else, as well as I like to, there's going to be a book club that you can join and talk books with other like-minded book lovers. So come and join the fun there. And Idra, thank you so much for hanging out with me. This has been a total blast. I'm so glad you could actually hang out. Reminds me why I started making this show in the first place. So thank you.
Well, thank you for having me. I had a great time too.
Wonderful.